Hello, I'm Kevin Kunzman, Managing Editor of HCP Live. Welcome to Doc Talk. If you're listening to this on the very day it went live, we are just a few hours away from the start of the 2020 European Society of Cardiology Virtual Congress, a meeting which, on our editorial schedule, generally marks the beginning of the fall medical meeting season. Though we're always excited to dive into the dozen-odd conferences across nearly as many specialties that make up the home stretch of our year, cardiology discussion always has a particular priority for us. Obviously, as I record this for a five-figure attendee meeting that's being held virtually this weekend, coronavirus is the greatest public health issue in the world, but I had to usurp cardiometabolic disease for that distinction. And if there's any great singular lesson we can take away from what this pandemic has bore us through, it's that we must absolutely improve preventive medicine. At a clinical level, at a research level, at a diagnostic and screening level, at a prescribing level, at a level scaled to global health implication, we are failing to prevent crises, and it's limiting our ability to manage disease. So, the theme for our ESC coverage this weekend is preventive cardiology. We're going to highlight research, presentations, and perspectives that bolster the state of our preventive pharmacotherapy, diagnostics, and screening capabilities. And this episode of Doc Talk, in serving as a primer for ESC, will stay on that theme as well. Today I'm joined by Dr. Amit Khera, a preventive cardiologist at UT Southwestern Medical Center and president of the American Society of Preventive Cardiology. After reviewing the current state of preventive cardiology research and applied care, Dr. Khera discusses the ESC agenda, how COVID-19 has influenced the state of cardiology meetings, and lessons learned from his own experiences in leading the ASPC annual meeting just this last summer. We hope you enjoy the chat. So Dr. Khera, obviously ESC kind of serves this interesting role of, I guess I would say, kicking off the fall cardiology conference season, to be followed by other more specific meetings, including HFSA and the AHA annual sessions later in the season. But, something that our team is particularly focused on is, again, the role of preventive cardiology. And we see it a lot right now with, some of the agents that are being discussed and some of the agendas that are being highlighted at ESC are really emphasizing the need for better prevention, just the de-escalation of patient severity and disease progression as it pertains to all these comorbidities that we're seeing in cardiometabolic disease, renal disease now, and the weight of mortality on it. I just wanted to, if we could start this off with setting our own primer for the discussion of, where do you see preventive cardiology right now in terms of the successes we've made and what we still have to do?
Well, thanks for that introduction. I'm obviously biased as a preventive cardiologist and the past president of the American Society for Preventive Cardiology. But, I think the future is prevention. It always has been. It's just that the world takes a little while to come around. And as you know, for lots of different reasons, the way our healthcare system is structured and so forth, it's always been more back-end focused. But that pivot has been happening for decades now with epidemiology, with new treatments, with proof of efficacy, of marked changes and reductions in cardiovascular death in society with prevention. So the future is really bright and getting more exciting every day.
Sure, absolutely. And if we wanted to look into those agents particularly, obviously there's a few specific drug classes that have made great ground, I'd say, in the last decade plus, and are being met by even newer candidates as soon as last year going into this year. Are there any, in terms of some of these cardiovascular diseases that we see, playing a greater role for the field itself?
Sure. I might break it down on two fields, if you will. One is sort of people with advanced needs and newer agents. The other is sort of, population health and things like that. I just want to spend one second on the population health side. As we know, looking at COVID, about all the illness and severity, and we know that people are, at risk of cardiovascular disease or have cardiovascular disease are more afflicted by it. So it does tell us we have this sort of broad population. We need a healthier population so we're more resilient. That's been loud and clear. things that are available on that more kind of focused prevention side, as you know, lipid management and lipid-lowering therapy had a pause for several years, so really there wasn't a lot new. And I think some were even saying, you know, lipid management is dead, essentially, that we get, you know, statins and that's it. And, you know, we're really seeing the reemergence, so that's a very exciting area with PCSK9 inhibitors and now that, you know, newer agents that are coming out that have longer half-lives. So we have some other drugs that work on the LDL pathways and, you know, various other therapies that are coming down the pipeline. So we're really seeing a reemergence, a re-engagement, and we know there's a lot more we can do.
Right. And in terms of PCSK9 inhibitors, it seems in recent years they have certainly made a step from certain therapies that change the entire scope of a patient's status usually are held in this, standard of just almost out of reach for the everyday patient. And it seems like they've taken a step in that time, especially some of the earliest competitor drugs, of becoming more accessible, being considered for greater indications, and just part of the more, normative treatment course, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, first is, I consider that class a game changer, if you will. I know particularly people with hypercholesterolemia and, our highest risk patients with atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, the opportunity to have these agents, at least in my prevention practice, has been really a huge boon. Pricing was quite high, hard to get. That's changed. As you know, prices come down a bit. They're easier to get these drugs. And
right.
We don't know this yet, but with the antisense technologies, the much longer half-lives or much longer effective lives, I think we'll also learn a little bit more about adherence and how that may change looking more broadly about improving patients' outcomes.
Right. Right. And speaking of adherence, obviously that's a continued discussion and almost a pain point, I'd say, right, for you and colleagues in terms of the statin discussion is one that's very necessary.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, bringing back to the two hats, the population side, we all know that, you know, for the vast majority of people that need lipid-lowering therapy, not everybody needs it, but, you know, statins are certainly the tried and true. Having said that, though, we know even out of all people prescribed the statin, especially primary prevention, you know, sometimes less than half are taking it in a year's time. So adherence is the biggest there by far. Mm-hmm. But for those that are more high risk or more advanced needs, it's good to have additional options as well.
Right. Right. Of course. And it almost seems as if it plays a role in preventive cardio and that, seeing such a great rate of patients, whether it's informed or slightly misinformed, that their concern of having to adhere to statin therapy once beginning it is almost as great a motivator as any to, if they are risk, to get it under control as best they can.
Right, and I think to pivot a little bit in our discussion and talking about risk itself, and one of the things that's being advanced more and more is the atherosclerosis imaging and other tools to help define risk better,
right.
Like calcium scanning and CT angiograms. And the reason that's so important is, one, is it helps us essentially, again, tell you who's at highest risk. And then we're also seeing that it's also, some work is evolving about how it tells us who may have the lowest number needed to treat, who gets the most return on investment for being on some of these newer agents. And finally, there's a decent amount of data for patients that when they see their scanner, they know that they have calcium, they're more likely to be adherent and make changes. Right. That makes sense because it makes intuitive to them that they really need the medicine.
Right. And let's stay on the topic of, improved diagnostic screening, monitoring, everything like that. I feel right now is especially emphasized at a time when, doctor visitation and continued care has been challenged, of course, by COVID-19, but that challenge has also presented new opportunities to expand our means of monitoring. And Dr. Kara, it seems certainly preventive cardio was making strides in the recent years of embracing opportunities of technology, including wearable devices, including just the use of the Internet of Things in households and telehealth measures. Can we talk a little bit about, the marriage of technology into both research and immediate practical care?
Sure, and I think, you know, of course, it's an evolving field. I mean, there's two parts to that. One is wearables and sensors, and that even gets into research where people are sort of doing sort of population cohorts, tracking sort of day-to-day activities in this manner. I think there's a lot of opportunity there, and I'll pivot a little bit, obviously, to COVID, where telehealth now has been a huge opportunity, where many practices by necessity, but now really have learned to embrace telehealth. So sure. Prevention is a perfect place for telehealth because our the necessity on the physical exam and a lot of the in-office testing is a little bit less. The regular visits with patients are more important. So the outpatient visit is so important for prevention. And to add to that is the wearables, because now for us to do remote blood pressure, weight, all those things, that's where you're not doing those in the office and checking those. We're relying on the patient to help us in that and creating that partnership. This is where the wearables can be very helpful. You know, we're all learning because right now you can get reams and reams of data and try to decide how that intersects in that medical record and how we get reimbursed for those type things. And even the fidelity of those, we're figuring that out. But I definitely see a great opportunity here.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And with it too comes, the discussion of, the primary care physician's role, the family doctor's role in managing that. I know that's something that's been a big stress point for us on HCP Live when exploring how telehealth has come to such prominence during the pandemic. It seems like a lot of it's fallen largely on the doctors that are being sought out first, of course, by patients who not only have questions about the risk of the virus, but need to continue monitoring their own care and finding those means. So, in a lot of cases, this population of physicians maybe weren't looking to use it as much in the past, obviously, as say some specialists, and their embrace of it has been pretty great. And relative to that, Dr. Kara, do you see the role of primary care continuing to evolve or progress in any kind of way in terms of responsibilities in preventive cardiology?
Yeah, to briefly on the telehealth and primary care, there's surveys been done where if you look at patients, even older patients, something like 50-60% were very interested in telehealth. This is pre-COVID, and many of the younger patients were willing to switch doctors if their doctor offered telehealth. So patients are going to speak with their feet, and they will align where they have the best convenience and effectiveness. The marriage of primary care and preventive cardiology is tight. In the end of the day, preventive cardiologists, people that focus on that, we could never see every patient in the U.S. population. That's never going to be feasible. So the primary care is where all the screening, the initial assessments, the referrals happen. And so it's a really important partnership. And so we need to better empower and give tools to primary care doctors to help identify people at highest risk, help in risk factor management, and then know when to refer for those with more complex issues.
Mm-hmm. Switching gears just a little bit, Dr. Kara, again, to the ESC virtual sessions beginning next week. Obviously, the American Society of Preventive Cardiology, you guys had your own virtual sessions occur just last month, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it's something that's always interesting to follow up on with, regular attendees, organizers, presenters, with everything going on due to the pandemic, everything switched to virtual and discussing the agendas and just, the opportunities for collaboration and network. I wanted to see if you came out of, the ASPC virtual sessions with any kind of, takeaways or even advice for, upcoming or any future planned cardiology virtual sessions. Is there anything that you learned from it?
I certainly did. First, let me say, although it was born out of necessity, we didn't have a choice. In retrospect, I got to say it was a wonderful experience and event and went far better than we could have thought. And when I say better, our goal is to have improve and impact care and educate those that are interested in the field of prevention. The things that were fantastic, things that went so well, one is that we reached a much bigger audience. Our attendance sure. level was higher than we've ever had at one of our face-to-face conferences. Second is the breadth of people. There were people from all over the world. And also the breadth of levels. We had trainees to very senior faculty. You get that at all meetings, but the ability for them to all participate was definitely facilitated. The other thing that was fantastic, and this was really fun, was during every lecture was simulated, so we had recorded them, but the speakers were in the chat room. So we were having active discussions going on, very active during each one of the lectures, and all of our board members were chatting, and these are, you know, some of those experts in prevention. So I think if you were an attendee, you got so much out of the active dialogue.
Sure.
You know, usually you're sitting in a lecture and you're just listening and waiting for it to end if you're going to get the question. So that was a great part.
That's excellent. And yeah, I would say too, in my experience with hosted webinars and things of that nature, you know, that's something that has kind of stood to benefit from our virtual setting right now is the formality is a little bit more loosened, and it just leads to, you know, you think it wouldn't, but it actually leads to greater networking opportunity, more collaboration and discussion, brainstorming, everything like that. So yeah, it's one of those things that you think, well, no, it would be better served in person. But, you know, in terms of being able to host a greater number and in terms of being able to feel the discussion online versus the very, I guess, physically dependent, action of a lecture of a man at a podium with the only microphone and everyone else sitting aside. This is a much more communal setting for discussion, right? So.
Absolutely.
I mean, I can't help but imagine, obviously, we want to be in a state this time next year where, you know, we are meeting in person and are doing so safely and comfortably without, second thought of mine. But in the event that, you know, a virtual session would be at least encouraged, do you guys imagine that you'd want to build on that for another?
Yeah, we definitely, had some talks recently about that in discussions. And, you know, I think my personal opinion is I certainly share your vision that we wish we could be back together for lots of reasons. But I do think the virtual part of it should be a component and complement no matter what we do, in my opinion. Because again, if our goal is to reach people and influence change and practice, we need to reach as many people as we can in many different ways that we can. So I hope it remains a component of what we do, hopefully complementing face-to-face.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great idea, and I think that's something that can also be applied to the discussion of, actual care. There should be a marriage, an application of telemedicine in some kind of regard to it, just make it more optimized for everyone. So,
yeah, one of the parts that I'll just say is that we because of the formatting, because of recording, it's so much easier to make enduring educational materials versus bringing in a camera person to, record things and things like that. So the ability to generate content for ongoing learning is also greatly facilitated by this format.
Wow, yeah, that's excellent. And, just really, really feeds into, the narrative that, despite the circumstances that we've been given, I really feel like medical fields across every specialty have found ways to strive still. And if anything, sort of improve their methods of research, collaboration, network, optimize care. It seems like there was a lot of breakthroughs that we've made in the field in recent months that a circumstance like COVID-19 would have required to have happened for them to have occurred, or at least this soon.
It certainly has been an accelerator. I mean, there's no question, accelerated by necessity. But, nothing is good about COVID.
No.
But it has offered opportunities out of necessity. And, telehealth being a big one, that's a huge one. These conferences and flipping formats, not just there, but even in our hospitals and our educational settings. Obviously, the other thing, which is a little bit back to prevention, it's exposed, frankly, gaps societally, both looking at ethnic disparities, looking at our practices around prevention. So as a preventive cardiologist, it's really exposed us as to how much more work we have to do.
Absolutely. And, that's a huge point. In fact, it's, something I feel comes up in every other discussion we have about COVID now is, it really does shine a light on the ugly cracks of healthcare disparity and everything in that nature. And I feel like that's something that's been a headlining issue for cardiology for years and years now. And, hopefully the sort of reinvigoration of the topic and discussion around it leads to some changes. And, Dr. Kara, I don't want to put you on the spot with, tasking you on this, but just curious if you have any suggestions on where we need to go cardiology specific in healthcare disparity.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. And I will say again, in our Congress, we had a spotlight session on racial and ethnic differences in cardiovascular disease, as well as gender differences. We spent a fair number of talks, and we learned a tremendous amount. And I think, first and foremost, back on the prevention side, we have to understand how to make prevention work for all different groups, appreciate how all groups are different. One of the big one of the big paradigms, which is well known, but again, spotlight is social determinants of health. You know, it's not so much us what we prescribe in our offices one by one to a patient, but what's underpinning a lot of these disparities and poor outcomes. And social determinants of health is front and center. Not something, you know, doctors think about enough, but something we need to think about more.
Yeah, for sure, and certainly in the role of cardiology, it certainly starts at the preventive, you know, state in terms of, you know, maybe improved literature, education, access, and reach to patients, and just building a bridge there first and foremost, and setting it as a priority for these at-risk groups across both.
Absolutely, and I think the key word there is priority, you know, and reprioritizing, refocusing our efforts on that.
Because certainly it seems the research and the therapeutic options are as accelerated as they have been and expanding and proven to be beneficial, right? So it's just a matter of utilizing them right.
Yeah, correct. And I think it's the basics. You know, having people have economic security, be able to come to physicians, have people. You know, we think about some biases in medicine in terms of treatment, so make sure everyone has not only access and equitable access, but that care is given equitably as well. And that, even if we did all that with even the basics, meaning lifestyle, sometimes blood pressure and statins and things like that, we would greatly close these disparity gaps. And then, of course, there are advanced therapies, which we certainly see there are disparities there as well. And those have a role, but probably a little less in terms of closing that gap.
All right, Dr. Kerr, is there anything else you want to add regarding, just the state of preventive cardiology, virtual sessions right now, any take-home messages beyond what we discussed at ASPC or looking forward to ESC or any of these other fall meetings?
Right. I mean, you know, I think you're going to see a lot of great things coming out in prevention of these different meetings. We talked a lot about lipids. We didn't talk quite as much about some of the cardiometabolic parameters, but the diabetes space is exploding with these new therapeutic agents and options, and how they're helping not just with diabetes management, but heart disease, kidney disease, and many other domains. So that's a very exciting area. The other thing, just jumping around, I also want to mention thalamus prevention is just preventive cardiology as a field. It's prevention itself is not young, but the field of specialists in preventive cardiology is a bit younger, and what that means. As ASPC, we're working to define that more, and hopefully get more trainees involved in that. And then we also have a new journal, American Journal of Preventive Cardiology. And I say all that to say that I think the not the field of prevention in general, but the discipline of preventive cardiology is sharpening, and hopefully we'll get more and more people entering that discipline as the years go on.
That's fascinating. If you don't mind me asking, what exactly goes into, I guess, not only kickstarting the journal, but looking for the means by which you can build a foundation on you know, this focus.
It's interesting if you look, whether you look at the family of JAG or family of CIRC or US-based journals, there is no preventive cardiology journal. There's some of these spinoffs, but they're imaging and electrophysiology. Your ESC does have a spinoff journal, European Journal of Preventive Cardiology, but there was never one in the United States, which is telling in and of itself, if you ask us in preventive cardiology.
Sure.
That had not been focused. I'll tell you that when we started this journal, we all knew in our hearts that there would be a lot of interest and that it was important. And then as soon as it was launched by Sergio Fazio, our editor-in-chief, and Megan Wong, our executive editor, boy, have we seen an outpouring of papers being sent our way. Because there's no home for this, and there should be, you know. And it not only gives us a chance to share scientific literature and prevention, which there's, again, not a specific journal for that, but also thought pieces and opinion pieces about what does it mean to be a preventive cardiologist. We've had a paper on COVID and prevention and, you know, just things that are very specific to prevention societally as a field in addition to scientific matter.
That's really cool. That's really interesting. And you're right. It certainly is telling, unfortunately, that, such an American publication is lacking, and it's great to see that introduced.
And I'll say it was lacking, right?
Yeah. It's something an expert on the other side of virology said to me just a couple weeks ago is the U.S. is not good at prevention in general. We're not good at prevention. It's something we really need to focus on, and certainly in cardiology. I think a lot of people forget because of the current public health crises, but the greatest one we've had prior to COVID, of course, was cardiometabolic disease rates. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. All right, Dr. Kerr, is there anything else you want to add?
No, thanks so much for your time, Kevin. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. I really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thanks again to Dr. Kara for his time, expertise, and insight. For more podcasts, visit our podcast page on hcplive.com. And for more ESC coverage, check us out on Facebook and Twitter, or register for our daily newsletter at the site. I'm Kevin Kunzman. Thank you for listening to Doc Talk.